Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
We sent a message that we want a better nation, that we demand a better nation.
In my family, there were no girl chores or boy chores. There's just things to get done.
We believe diversity and representation make us great.
And one of the first Muslim women elected to Congress.
Because now Nevada joins to be the fifth state with two women senators.
Voices of the many women who won their races in the midterm elections yesterday. Nevada now with two female senators. Tennessee, Arizona, their first female senators. South Dakota's first female governor. California's first Korean-American congresswoman. Kansas and New Mexico send Native American women to Congress for the first time. Minnesota and Michigan elect the first Muslim women to the House. Just a few of the more than 100 women who won congressional and gubernatorial races yesterday out of more than 270 who ran. So this hour on Point, 2018, the year of the woman or women, how far they've come and how far there's still to go. And you can join us. What do you make of this year's record-setting female candidate list? What kind of leaders will they make? Was this an anomalous year for women and female representation or the start of a bigger, longer, and long overdue trend? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first today from New York is Rebecca Traister. She's writer-at-large for New York Magazine and author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, and All the Single Ladies. Rebecca Traister, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you. So what's your reaction to these victories of now more than 115, almost 117 women in the midterm elections yesterday?
Well, it's certainly one of those moments, and you know, one of the past moments that a lot of people might be thinking of is 1992, which was called the Year of the Woman. At that point, it was the victory of 23 women in the House and 4 women in the Senate. Mm-hmm. A lot of which those victories took place in the wake of anger that women felt after having watched the Anita Hill testimony and the all-white, all-male Senate Judiciary panel that treated Anita Hill so badly when she told her story of having been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas. And some of the anger that women felt at their lack of representation led so many of them to run the next year in an election where there also happened to be a number of open seats. And that was the sort of last celebrated year of the woman. And of course, we see similar patterns now. The anger that so many women felt in response to the victory of Donald Trump in 2016, and that maybe found its first initial expression in that Women's March in January of 2017. And back during that Women's March, you heard lots of people sort of saying, oh, but what is this? It's just with the hats. And the women saying, no, we're going to run for office. We're going to support women running for office. And that's part of what we're seeing, is that process bearing fruit two years later. I think one of the most important things to note about it, since it is a sort of moment of massive correction, but not full correction, yeah, representationally, so many of the women who won last night are women of color. And that is absolutely crucial that we talk about that aspect of it, because women of color, specifically Black women, but women of color have long been the Democratic Party's base and have gone dreadfully underserved and underrepresented by that party and by major party politics in general.
Well, so let's listen to some of the victory speeches last night from at least a couple of those women. First of all, Democrat Ilhan Omar became one of Minnesota's congressional representatives last night. And in her victory speech, she noted the titles that she's now first to hold.
The first woman to wear a hijab to represent. The first refugee ever elected to Congress. And one of the first Muslim women elected to Congress. A title I share with my beautiful sister from Michigan, Rashida Tlaib.
That's Ilhan Omar then also noting that in Michigan, Rashida Tlaib won her race as well. In New Mexico, last night, Democrat Deb Haaland became the first, or one of the first, I should say, Native American women elected to Congress.
Today, we all came together and we said we still believe in the American dream, in American democracy, and in hope. We still believe America is stronger when we work together. We believe diversity and representation make us great.
That's New Mexico's Deb Haaland last night. The other Native American woman to win last night was Democrat Charisse Davids in Kansas's 3rd District. So, Rebecca Traister, I mean, reflect with me on how significant this is. You were talking about that a second ago, but I think we should explore more how, for a long time, Democrats have relied, even curried favor with women of color in terms of voters, but didn't necessarily make room for them in the party in terms of actual politicians or representatives. Are you seeing that changing now?
Well, it should be changing. I mean, I think it was the women and the candidates themselves who insisted that it was changing this time. I don't know that the Democratic Party infrastructure, that the Democratic Party establishment was particularly keen on a lot of these candidates when they started running. A lot of these women weren't taken seriously. You look at somebody like Lauren Underwood in Illinois. She ran in her primary against 6 white men. She's an African-American nurse. I believe she's 32. Mm-hmm. A lot of these women are also young. We should talk about that. That means that they are the potential future of this party. But Lauren Underwood was certainly an underdog in her Illinois House primary race, and she wound up winning against 6 white men. And then last night she won her race in Illinois for a House district. Lucy McBath, now her race in Georgia's 6th district is, as of my knowledge at this moment, still undecided, but she's in the lead by a few hundred votes. She was not somebody that the party took particularly seriously. She won her primary and then was in a runoff and won her primary. So I don't know that this is indicative right now of the party having newly invested in them. I think it's indicative of the women insisting that they were going to lead the party forward in the aftermath of that 2016 election. And I hope that the party infrastructure is paying attention and looking to these women for leadership, because I believe that they are the future of the party, that they must be the future of the party.
All right. Well, you mentioned Lauren Underwood. We have some tape from her last night. She unseated 4-term Republican Congressman Randy Hultgren, making her the first woman of color to represent the district. Her district now, just outside of Chicago.
Tonight, November 6, 2018, I stand before you as this community's first Congresswoman elect. If that's not standing on the shoulders of giants, I don't know what is. Together on this night, we made history. We made history.
Underwood, I should know, is a registered nurse and was previously a senior advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services under the Obama administration. And interestingly, back in March, I'm seeing here, she told Elle.com, she said, I'm a 31-year-old black woman. I am doubted in 8 of the 10 conversations I have. But here's what she says she's learned. You can see it on people's faces. If you exceed their expectations, something switches and they start to respect you. But what that means for her and her team is she has to be excellent every day at everything she does, because she's being underestimated and counted out. And she says, we need to exceed expectations at all time. At all times. That's Lauren Underwood, who won her congressional race last night. Well, I want to welcome into the conversation on that note Simone Sanders. She's joining us from Washington. She's a Democratic strategist and a CNN contributor. Simone Sanders, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing well. So we were just talking about Lauren Underwood and several other women who won yesterday. Later in the hour, we'll talk about Republican women who won. But tell me about what you see in these female victories for the future of the Democratic Party.
Look, I see that women led the Democrats to victory in the House of Representatives, and frankly, in governorships and in state legislative races across the country. And what is different this midterm that has been different than 2016, than in the previous midterm, is that women weren't just stepping up and bringing their, you know, families and galvanizing people to the polls. They were, in fact, on the ballot. And so not only Lauren Underwood in the 14th Congressional District, we saw the first 2 Muslim women elected to Congress in from Michigan and from Minnesota. We saw Johanna Hayes from Connecticut, the first African-American woman to be elected from Connecticut. Ayanna Pressley, the first African-American woman to be elected from Massachusetts. So these are historic firsts, I think, that will have far-reaching implications past 2018, 2019, and 2020. There's a whole host of data that suggests when women are in office, better things happen. We make better decisions. And frankly, the election of Marsha Blackburn and so many other Republican women across the board, not as many as the Democratic women, because to be clear, it was a Democratic wave for women last night. But I think the election of Republican women to the House, but also some state legislative seats across the country, will prove to make a real difference in policy.
Yeah. But so, Simone, respond to what Rebecca Traister was saying a minute or two ago, that, you know, these women, a lot of them, you know, kind of did it of their own accord, that the Democratic Party itself, in terms of its political infrastructure, its fundraising prowess, its ability to help the get out the vote machine, that perhaps it, you know, the party didn't throw its weight behind some of these candidates in the way that it should have or might do in the future. So, you know, could this be getting the Democratic Party to be more on board with diversifying the ranks of the politicians that it's that are actually running?
I think last night says as much about the Democratic Party as it says about where voters across the country are. And to me, it says that the party missed the mark on some instances. You talk about Lauren Underwood. Lauren Underwood was, yes, a member of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee's historic Red to Blue program, where this year they had 92 seats on their Red to Blue program. But Lauren Underwood was not someone that the Democratic Party nationally or in Illinois asked to run. But she put her name on the ballot herself anyway. So I think there's a conversation that has to be had on the Democratic side the aisle about what we consider elective a viable candidate, who we consider electable. And the powers that be, I think, have to rethink electability, because Johanna Hayes, Ayanna Pressley, Lauren Underwood, on down the line, these are Sharice Davis, these are folks, Sharice Davis in Kansas City, these are people that stepped up on their own without the help and assistance of the party.
Well, Simone Sanders, stand by here for just a second. I have to take a quick break, but I want to ask you a couple of questions about that, about what you're saying when we come right back. We're talking about the more than 270 women who ran for congressional and gubernatorial seats in the 2018 midterms. 117, at least, of them won. So what does that mean for women in politics? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about all the women who ran for Congress and gubernatorial seats in the 2018 midterm elections. More than 270 of them, more than 115 of them won their races. So what does that mean for women in politics? What does that mean for American politics in general? Rebecca Traister joins us today. Simone Sanders is also with us from Washington. She's a Democratic strategist and CNN contributor. And Simone, I know I've got to let you go here in a minute, but there was one more question I wanted to ask you because you were sort of heading in this direction before we had to take a break. And you were talking about how in previous election cycles, up until very recently, the Democratic Party, even though many of these women who won last night ran as Democrats, that the party itself may not have seen them as electable. And I just want to reflect on something with you with that, because, you know, here we are based in Boston. So I've had many a conversation with now Congresswoman-elect Ayanna Pressley. And, you know, when she ran in her primary here in Massachusetts, she ran against, you know, a long-term Democratic congressman here, Michael Capuano, a progressive congressman. And, you know, even African-American members of the Democratic establishment aligned themselves behind Capuano and not her.
Yeah.
And she told me, she said, it's almost a Democratic trope now that they'll say they look to black women to be the saviors of the Democratic Party at the ballot box, but they will not make room for them as candidates. So, you know, all the way until 2018, until she proved that she could win, and we can point to other races as well, that has been a truism. So how much is that changing?
Look, I think Ayanna Pressley is absolutely right, and I'm happy to see her going to Congress. The fact of the matter is that the Democratic Party apparatus, the Democratic Party establishment, is not going to move to make room for women of color, particularly black women, Latina women, on the ballot in some spaces and places. They're just frankly not. And so that's why what we saw last night is so important, that women of color, particularly women of color running, you know, for Congress and other statewide elected offices, have to step up and choose themselves. And the way we gain power, the way folks bust open the doors and really get permanent seats at the table, as Shirley Chisholm would say, is if they don't give you a seat, bring a folding chair, is to step up ourselves. The Democratic Party will not be able to ignore what happened yesterday. And I know lots of people are going to take credit, but the fact of the matter is that a number of these women were not asked and were not recruited by the Democratic Party establishment. That's not something they will ever forget. And I bet you, I can bet my bottom dollar, Ayanna Pressley won't forget either.
Well, Simone Sanders, Democratic strategist and CNN contributor, joining us today from Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Traister, what's your response to what you heard Simone say?
I agree with her completely. I mean, I think that we're sort of saying the same thing. And this is, you know, she cited Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to Congress 50 years ago this year. And Shirley Chisholm also said the systems aren't going to do it for women. Women must become their own revolutionaries. For women of color, again, who have been relied on over and over again, not just as voters, but as the organizers, the volunteers, the get out the vote, the workers who have done so much of the pioneering intellectual work behind progressive movements in this country, and yet who have found so little representation in its major party politics. This is the lesson of this election cycle, which is to run, to, in some senses, defy conventional party wisdom about who can run. I would look also to Stacey Abrams, the gubernatorial mm-hmm. candidate in Georgia. Now, Stacey Abrams at this hour, I believe, she has not conceded. The race may or may not go to a runoff. It's extremely tight in her race against Brian Kemp. But Stacey Abrams has come as close as we could imagine without yet having won to becoming the first black woman governor in this country's history. And she did that. A lot of people told me that Stacey Abrams could not win in Georgia. And she may not. She may not win this race. But she is so close. It is so possible that she could have won this race. And many people would tell you that she should not have run. But she did. She ran an incredible race. And the speech she gave last night, I was up very late. Mm-hmm. The speech that Stacey Abrams gave last night, that was a speech that was not a concession speech. It was a pledge to keep fighting, presumably toward a runoff or a recount, was one of the most inspiring political speeches I have ever heard in my life. It made me think of Barack Obama's 2004 convention speech. Stacey Abrams is a future star of this party, as are some of the other big candidates who were not traditional white male candidates within a Democratic Party. Andrew Gillum and Beto O'Rourke, they lost their races, their big high-profile races, but they are part of a future of a Democratic Party. And I think that that's what we have to acknowledge last night did, is it set up a future. These are young candidates. Many of them are very progressive, and they are determined to reshape and reconfigure what political representation can look like on the left.
Right. Well, since you mentioned Stacey Abrams and her speech last night, as you noted, not a concession speech there, because we do not have a conclusion to that gubernatorial race in Georgia. Here's just a little bit of what she said.
We believe our chance for a stronger Georgia is just within reach. But we cannot seize it until all voices are heard. And I promise you tonight, we're going to make sure that every vote is counted.
That's Stacey Abrams last night in Georgia. Let's go to some callers here. Jenny is calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say, I'm not extremely politically active. I vote, but I was surprised at how emotional I was after the last presidential election. I'm a mother of three young daughters, and it was a little depressing. But after last night and just kind of seeing all the headlines coming out and seeing all these women, minority women, it's making me a lot more hopeful that this might be a really good time to be raising girls, that my daughters can grow up in a world that you want them to be in, not what it looked like a couple of years ago.
Well, Jenny, hang on here for just a second, because I've got a comment coming in online on our website from John Evergreen, and he's asking, he says, try to imagine yourself as a young woman or a little girl. How does it feel to know that there has never been a female president? So how hopeful are you?
I'm really hopeful because my little girls, I mean, this is what they're going to see. I'm in my mid-30s, so I've been seeing this change coming, and it's very powerful, but this is all my girls will know. They'll know that it's possible. When Hillary Clinton ran, it was, you know, oh, this could be a big momentous, you know, occasion. This never happened, but for my daughters, hey, somebody's ran before. It's just a matter of time before it's my turn or before I can do it.
Yeah. Jenny, I'm
I just think it's a very different...
Sorry, Jenny. Go ahead. I'm sorry about that.
Oh no. I'll take my comment off there.
Okay, but thank you so much for your call, and sorry for some of the rough edges of live radio. But Jenny, thank you so much. Let's go to Victor, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Victor, you're on the air.
Hey, Magna. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I wanted to just bring up, you know, the first woman governor winning in Maine, Mrs. Mills. Mm-hmm. Her winning, and you know, congratulations to her for sure, and that being great. But also, I just have one comment about just Donald Trump in general and what he's done with the race across America. I did not vote for him. I am not a Republican. I am a Democrat. But sometimes in history, you may not get the president you want, but maybe you get the president you need for the time that you need it. And, you know, Donald Trump is doing a lot of things through his rhetoric that we do not like, but maybe he's really kind of bolstering and firing up that women's movement as he did with the march and everything else to really kind of lead and bring a lot of these women to the forefront, great women who have been running and winning in a lot of different places.
Yeah, well, Victor, thank you so much for your call. Rebecca Traister, what do you think of Victor's take here?
Well, I certainly think that women are coming to the forefront of our politics, and some of them are doing so in response to Donald Trump. That said, I think that the harm he is inflicting on human beings, on their families, on their economic stability, I think it's hard to see a silver lining for me in the Trump presidency. But I do think it is simultaneously true, while perhaps not a silver lining, that you're seeing people politically and civically engaged, people who have been previously passive or somnambulant. But I do have to raise a point in the midst of this conversation, because we're talking about women and women's activation. And I have just published a book about women's anger, women's political anger, and how that feeds into so much of what we're talking about. But we have to break down what we mean when we're talking about women.
Yeah.
Because white women voted for Donald Trump. According to exit polls in 2016, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. And I have to say that last night, there were some numbers that we really need to acknowledge. In Georgia, reportedly, according to the exit poll data that I've seen, 76% of white women in Georgia voted against Stacey Abrams, voted for Brian Kemp, the conservative Republican who has run a kind of openly open campaign of voter suppression, especially the suppression of black and brown voters. 76% of white women voted for Brian Kemp. 59% of white women in Texas voted for Ted Cruz over Beto O'Rourke.
But of course,
and
no
so
one,
when
no
we're
one,
talking,
yeah. But I just want to just jump in here because I think I see where you're going, and I'll let you finish in a second here, Rebecca. But
yeah.
no one ever said that just because a woman is running that women should vote for them because they share gender, right?
Oh no, not at all. But I just wanted to make that. I just wanted to bring up that point because I do think, and I find myself engaged in this too because I write about women, you know, and I talk about women, and I talk about women as an oppressed majority, and they are. But it is also true that we want to acknowledge the different patterns and the ways in which power plays out amongst the broad group that we label women.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, we got a comment here from someone calling themselves Robin Wood, who has sent a comment to onpointradio.org. And Robin Wood says, it's sad that rather than concentrating on individuals, On Point chooses to perpetuate the old way of thinking, looking at people first based on their group identity, as if that's the most remarkable thing about them, what they were born into, male, female, black, white, gay, straight, et cetera, rather than their personal attributes, thoughts, and accomplishments. So, I mean, it seems as if Robin Wood saying that we're making too much of a big deal that all these women are running simply because they're women.
Hmm. Well, I think that it's, you know, it's hard to not acknowledge how identity plays into who has had political power and who has political power in a country that was founded, you know, in a way in which massive populations, African Americans and women were denied the franchise for decades, for centuries, in which African Americans were enslaved, in which you know, up until last night, women represented 23% of Congress. This is a country that prides itself on being a representative democracy, but has not, in fact, been representative in its governing bodies. And so it's hard to talk about politics and electoral realities without acknowledging the kinds of discrepancies in power and electability that have existed throughout our history and that persist still.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I wish Robin Wood were here or on the phone, because what I might say to this person, and I don't know if Robin Wood's male or female, but that sometimes it is important to talk about attributes such as gender, because that's how the world sees us first and foremost. So
yes,
that's one response I'd have for Robin Wood. But let's hear from a few more of the women who ran in these 2018 midterm elections and won. First of all, here's Democrat Abigail Spanberger. She won an upset victory in Virginia's 7th district last night against Republican Dave Brat.
We won an unwinnable district by doing exactly what every campaign should do. We focused on the needs of the people, the voters. We talked about the substantive issues affecting their lives. We stood up for American values, and we brought respect and decency back to the political arena.
That's Abigail Spanberger in Virginia. Over in Texas, Democrat Lizzie Fletcher unseated 9-term Republican Congressman John Culberson in their Houston district.
This is the most important election of my lifetime. And it's not because my name is on the ballot. My name is on the ballot because it's the most important election of our lifetime.
That's Lizzie Fletcher, who won her congressional seat in Texas last night. Rebecca Traister, you know, this is a remarkable moment for women. There's no doubt about it. But I'm a numbers person when it comes down to it, and I think that we need a bit of a reality check. You mentioned it a minute ago, but let's dig into this. In the House right now, 435 available seats total. 84 is the record number of women we've had ever out of those 435 seats. As of last night, though, that number's bumped up to 96 seats. But we're still not even at 25% for women in the House. Yeah. So, you know, we can talk about how momentous 2018 was, but there is a huge way to go if we're talking that if we even desire as a nation to have some sort of representative democracy for the 50% of the population of this country who are women.
Well, this has been the great ongoing struggle throughout America's history, has been this dual struggle both for representation and for enfranchisement, which, of course, is very much at stake in what happened yesterday, the idea of expanding the electorate or restricting it. And that, of course, makes a difference who what kind of voters can vote for what kind of candidates. This has been, I mean, these are the struggles behind the suffrage and the civil rights movement, the movement toward the Voting Rights Act, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. All of these are about who, what kinds of Americans can have what kinds of power in public and political life. And it is a struggle. And one of the things I found so moving in Ayanna Pressley's speech last night, she said, she got up and she said, and she won decisively. And she got up and she said, this is not a victory speech. Until there is justice and equality, then I will declare victory. She positioned herself very much not at the end of a fight as the victor, but in the midst of a fight. And I think that's what so many of the people, especially those who are new to activism and new to electoral engagement in the past couple of years, need to remember, that we were not leading up to this one midterm moment and we were going to get the answer and win or lose. That basically what we're committing to is a lifetime in a struggle toward something closer to the equality and representative democracy that we were officially promised at our founding, but that promise we know has never really been met.
Well, we are talking about the 270 plus women who ran for Congress or the governor's office in these midterm elections and the more than 100 of them who won and what that means for American politics in 2018 and going forward. Before we have to take a quick break here, let's hear another one. This is Democrat Jackie Rosen, who defeated Republican incumbent Senator Dean Heller in Nevada's Senate race yesterday.
On a night when women are winning up and down the ballot, this is a historic night for us. Because now Nevada joins to be the fifth state with two women senators.
Jackie Rosen in Nevada last night. We've been talking a lot about the Democrats because most of the women who ran this year were Democrats, but the Republicans also had some major victories with female candidates. We'll talk about them when we come back. We're talking about whether or not 2018 is the year of the woman for American politics and what that means for 2020, 2022, and for the future in general. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about all the women who ran in the 2018 midterm elections, a historic number of them, more than 270. More than 115 of them won their races at the congressional and gubernatorial levels. I'm joined today by Rebecca Traister. She's writer-at-large for New York Magazine and author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Now, for a lot of this hour, we've been focusing on Democratic women who ran in the midterms because most of the women who ran did run as Democrats. But the Republican Party also had a very strong showing among some women who ran for them. First of all, for example, here's Republican Kristi Noem and her victory speech last night after winning the gubernatorial election in South Dakota. She is now South Dakota's first female governor.
In my family, there were no girl chores or boy chores. There was just things to get done. So that's what we're going to do. I have some big plans for this state. Addressing education, meeting our workforce needs, going after affordable housing, affordable health care, dealing with our mental health crisis, and also addressing our rising crime and drug issues here in South Dakota.
That's Kristi Noem, who won the gubernatorial race in South Dakota last night. She'll be South Dakota's first female governor, and she's a Republican. Moving over to Tennessee, Republican Marsha Blackburn beat her Democratic rival last night, becoming Tennessee's first elected female senator.
The entire country has heard Tennessee loud and clear. I think that you sent a really good message. Tennesseans want a conservative U.S. senator who is going to take Tennessee values and put them to work for you in Washington, D.C.
That's Marsha Blackburn, Republican from Tennessee, and now Tennessee's first elected female senator. Let's go to Kevin, who's calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. You're on the air, Kevin.
Hi. Two things. First, I just wanted to say to your guests, I really enjoyed you on Sam Harris. And two, I am a little sad that Marsha Blackburn won Tennessee. It's really good that all these women are getting elected. She is the one that I was hoping wasn't going to get elected, but she's a little on the anti-LGBT side, and she falls in line with Trump on pretty much everything.
Yeah, but she won pretty handily, though, in Tennessee. So, Kevin, though, I thank you for your call and for your perspective. Let's get a different view on the Blackburn race. Sarah is calling us from Lincoln, Nebraska. Sarah, you're on the air.
Hello. I'm glad that that's been brought up because I've noticed in lots of NPR programming that there's been almost no mention of Blackburn, Marsha Blackburn. I was surprised when you discussed the Stacey Abrams race, and there was some discussion that her loss was attributed, perhaps her potential loss, in part by racism against her, that there was no such concern or comment about John James losing in Michigan. As a black male, was his loss attributed to racism in Michigan?
Huh. Okay. Well, Sarah, thank you for your call. Rebecca Traister, do you have a response to Sarah?
Well, I mean, I think that anytime you're talking about non-white candidates, anytime you're talking about, openly gay candidates, you're always talking about the possibility that sort of structural bias, individual bias plays a role. I haven't been looking carefully at the James race, yes, I think that, when you run candidates who are not our traditional model for political leadership, which is white, straight, male, cisgendered, you're talking about all kinds of biases that come into play.
Yeah. And just so that people understand the race that we're talking about, the Michigan race was between Republican John James and Democrat Debbie Stabenow, I should say. And it looks like Stabenow's won about 52% of the vote there. Rebecca, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring in Sophia Nelson into the conversation. She's an author, journalist, and MSNBC political analyst. She's also Republican and former House Committee counsel, author of E Pluribus One, Reclaiming Our Founders' Vision for a United America. And she's with us from Washington. Sophia, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your take on sort of all the women who ran this year? We just heard some tape from victorious Republican females in their congressional bids here. Is this as momentous a year for Republican women as it is for Democratic women?
Well, you have 117, I think the count is, as of now, women elected to the Congress, which is historic. It's a record. The majority of them, however, particularly for new members, are Democrat women. You do have a couple Republican women. I think that it is clear after last night that the Republican Party has a lot of work to do with women voters, particularly suburban women voters, and recruiting women candidates who are well-funded and who can really win in their districts. My district is Virginia 10. Barbara Comstock was beat handily by another woman, and in fact, the Democrats elected three women from the Commonwealth to the Congress, which is a historic first because up till yesterday, Barbara Comstock was the only female in the delegation of the Congress. So I think the Republicans have a lot of work to do with women.
Do they have models at the gubernatorial level, though? Because we heard that tape earlier from Kristi Noem, South Dakota's first female governor now. In Iowa, Kim Reynolds won there, I'm seeing now. So it looks like at the state level, Republicans have always been very successful there. Could they build continue building on that model with women candidates?
You know, of course, you're right. The first woman governor I ever worked for was Christine Todd Whitman, and I'm dating myself now, way back in the 90s. But think of when she won. That was epic back then, right? I mean, there was no women really winning statewide or for governors or Senate. And now we fast forward and we see that now is much more commonplace. So I do think Republicans are having success statewide. But you know what? I think if we were to break down this election again with women, it really depends on where they were running, right? And whether those were red states or blue states. And I think the map for Republicans is a little more difficult for women, I think, because if you're looking at the demographics, the red states tend to be represented by white males overwhelmingly. So, again, the Republicans have work to do. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, so talk to me more about that, though, because, you know, earlier in the hour we were talking about how Democrats, you know, look to black women as a reliable, quote-unquote, reliable vote and maybe aren't making room for them in the party as actual representatives. I mean, women overall are more than half of the electorate here. So is it time, too, that the Republican Party, you know, look to women for a future generation of leadership?
Well, yeah, I think that's going to be a big discussion that, again, we're going to have, particularly here in states like Virginia that used to be reliably red, and now then they were purple when Obama was president. Now it's blue. Look, I'm an African-American Republican woman. Can you imagine how bad that is? And if you think that the black women in the Democrat Party who have been the core of the Democrat Party, I don't think anybody can argue that, feel like they're being left out. Imagine being a woman of color in the Republican Party. Mia Love was one. She was the first black woman elected as a Republican to Congress, and I believe she lost in Utah. But again, Utah is an entirely different discussion than I think what we're talking about here in the Beltway, et cetera, and more moderate suburban type of women candidates and voters. So I do think that the GOP has a lot of work to do with people of color in general. Right now, if we're going to tell the truth, and I'm a truth teller, the Republican Party is a white male, white female party that is much more rural. It's not really, I don't know if you could even call it Republican anymore. I think it's a Trump party. Mm-hmm. I think particularly after some of the more moderate Republicans lost as casualties of the president's rhetoric. So, yeah, the GOP's got a lot of work to do on people of color and women, for sure.
You know, one more thing I want to ask you, Sophia, and Rebecca, I want to get your response to what Sophia is saying here, though. When I talk to a lot of younger Republican women, for example, though, I hear the person they're most excited about, not for 2020, but for 2024, is Nikki Haley. Though,
yep.
So, I mean, could we? This is so far away, granted, but is it seems to me as potentially ironic that, you know, I heard everything you said about the Republican Party and women, but there's a lot of excitement over a potential future female presidential candidate on the Republican side.
Well, I think, look, Nikki Haley is an exception to the rule. What do I mean by that? Anytime you can win elections as a woman and a woman of color in particular, now you're a standard bearer. Nikki's the best thing the GOP has going for it right now. If we're going to tell the truth again, she is a woman. She's a woman of color, Indian. She's from a southern stronghold state that's very conservative, although a Democrat won that seat in Charleston last night. That's big. And I think that, you know, that's what makes her unique. And she conducts herself in a way, particularly having been part of the Trump administration, she didn't get caught up in the drama. She kept herself above the fray. She got out. She exited after 2 years. She's smart. So, yeah, I think we'll hear more from Nikki Haley in the future for sure.
Rebecca Traister, what do you think?
Well, I absolutely think we'll hear more from Nikki Haley in the future. I mean, one of the patterns in places that don't tend to elect women is that the I always expected growing up that likely the first woman president of the United States would be a Republican. I mean, this is the pattern. This is Margaret Thatcher in the UK. That often there's more space made for women who are willing to work on behalf of fundamentally conservative, and in this country at this point that means sort of white patriarchal policy and politics. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if Nikki Haley has a very bright future, presidential or otherwise. But one of the things that Sophia said that is interesting to me, she noted that the first Republican she worked for was Christine Todd Whitman. Mm. And in her discussion, she called the contemporary party really the party of Trump. I think it's a party that went hard right and made space for Donald Trump. I don't think Trump created the hard rightness of his party.
I think he represents a party that had moved in a super conservative direction. And that meant that some of the women who had been more moderate forces, whether it's Christine Todd Whitman, Olympia Snow, left the party. And so you're looking at a party that is nowhere near the center. And Nikki Haley herself is, in fact, pretty far right.
Yeah.
And that's one of the dynamics that makes it tricky to bring in people who are not white men.
Well, so technically speaking, though, Olympia Snow retired as a Republican, though. Right. But just,
yes. Oh, yeah. But she left. I mean, she chose to retire. I mean, I just am thinking of women who were in the party who made the choice to exit it.
Well, look at what Susan Collins just did, right? I mean, I think that underscores your point, right? That Susan Collins had a moment with the Kavanaugh vote to really kind of draw the line in the sand for the sisterhood, and she went in the other direction. And I think she did that for a number of reasons. One, Mitch McConnell was on her. The Boys Network was on her, like, you better not step out of line on this one, and we'll reward you because you've got an election in 2020, a re-election. And so I think your point is a good one, that it's more – I've always thought our first woman president, and I still think I'm right about this, will be a Republican woman, and I think she'll be more conservative. I think that women like Elizabeth Warren and others are – I think it's going to be difficult for them. Hillary Clinton was arguably probably the most qualified person on paper that we saw for president in a very long time. She was. And for her to lose to Donald Trump, I'm still smarting over that one. I'm a person who voted. I'm a Republican that voted for Hillary. But my point is, I think that you're right about it, that you have to kind of be a more conservative woman, I think, to go higher up the chain.
Yeah. So, so Sophia and Rebecca, hang on here for just a second, because before we run out of too much time, I want to get at least one more call. So let's go to Claire, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Claire, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you. I don't want to rain on everybody's parade, but the year of the woman is so 1980s. If this is a revolution, we're still taking baby steps. Mm. We will have the true year of the woman if and when we ever pass an equal rights amendment so that half this country has equal rights.
Claire, I totally hear you. No Shangri-La, no Pollyanna-ishness here at On Point. Thank you so much for your call. Sophia Nelson, what do you think?
I mean, she's right, obviously, in theory, but I don't know that we're ever going to get an Equal Rights Amendment. Its best chance of passing is when it was happening back a long time ago in the 70s, I believe it was. So I think that, you know, I hear her. Women still don't have equal pay for equal work. Women are now at 117 members of Congress. That means they're what, like we're like 20% now of the Congress,
right?
I think, something like that. And we're 50%+ of the population. So, yeah, look at the Fortune 500. We could talk about this all day and never be done. We're behind. We have work to do.
Let's go to Andrea, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Andrea, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really agree with everything that kind of has just been said, and including what Claire was saying. My biggest concern is, also not that we're not having a representative democracy, and that's actually reflected extremely in the Senate because, as we know, 85% of the U.S. population is represented by only 50 senators.
Oh, so saying that it's not representative of all of the country as a whole.
Exactly. Yeah.
But that, of course, is how the Senate was designed in the Constitution, right? So, I mean, I'm not sure we're ever going to get past that fundamental truth about it.
Well, I mean, that may be true, but I know that there are other things that were initially designed, like, for example, senators were not initially elected directly by the population. They were elected by state representatives as well. And so I think it's going to be hard. I think it is going to be hard for us to get that passed. The lack of true representation as long as it stands that way.
Well, Andrea, thank you so much for your call. Rebecca Traister and Sophia Nelson, we've just got about a minute left to go here, and I want to ask you both for your last thoughts on this question. You know, Rebecca, earlier in the hour, you talked about 1992 being the year of the woman following the Hill-Thomas hearings. And I take your point there. There was a huge surge of interest in female candidates, but then, as we have been talking about, we still don't have 25% representation even in the House. So I question the momentum here. Do you think it's different this time around in 2018, that the momentum around female candidates will carry longer than it did after 92?
I certainly hope so, but we can't just assume that it's going to. I think that you've seen momentum carry over the past 2 years, from marches to protests to teacher strikes to Me Too to electoral engagement. We certainly see a population of women who has shown us for the past few years that they're engaged and ready to stay engaged. But it is a fight that has to continue and that people have to commit to, again, for the rest of our lives. This is not going to be over with any one election.
Well, Sophia Nelson, we've got about 15 seconds left. Your last thought?
I agree. I mean, I think that women candidates have to be able to raise the money and get the nod and be able to be competitive in places where they can win. That's how we're going to change it.
Well, Sophia Nelson, Republican and former House Committee counsel, author, journalist, and MSNBC political analyst, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Rebecca Traister, writer-at-large for New York Magazine and author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Rebecca, thank you.
Thanks so much, Megna.
And listeners, let us know what you think about whether or not you believe this is the year of the woman in 2018. 277 women, that's a lot, who ran. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.